Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome back to the DMZ after we took a few weeks off here and there in the summer, and now we're going to try to string together a couple of consecutive weeks.
Well, it's go time. It's midterm time. You know, we're in the fall sprint. We have to, the candidates need their A games. The DMZ needs A game.
Right. After Labor Day, it's a full sprint until November. And by the way, Bill, National Review put out an editorial the other day saying Republicans don't have a plan. They don't have a message. And they said something to the effect of except to not make errors. And to which I said, that's asking a lot. That's asking enough of them. Like, if they can just go, speaking of stringing 2 weeks together, if they can just go between now and November without messing up, I think that's a win. Who needs messaging? The message is Obama's bad. That's the message. You don't need another contract with America at this point.
Well, I guess there's still it's not clear to me that that's probably sufficient to not lose seats. They're going to keep the House in all likelihood. They're going to pick up some Senate seats. Most people think that West Virginia and Montana and South Dakota are gimmies for Republicans in the Senate, but do they need a little more if they want to take the Senate? Can they just be that passive and say this is sort of naturally a referendum on Obama and he's in the low 40s and therefore we're going to get Iowa and Arkansas and Louisiana or Alaska or Colorado, three of those five will come our way if we just hang back.
Well, they are attacking these incumbent Democrats. I'm just saying, in terms of having some sort of a proactive, positive, overarching message, who needs that? I mean, look, number one, Democrats in 2006 captured Congress by basically being anti-Bush. They didn't really have a message, a governing philosophy per se. They just went against Bush and it worked. The other thing is, Bill, does anyone here really believe that the Republican chances are increased by them starting to talk about ideas? They don't have a coherent philosophy. Republicans are undergoing this identity crisis right now. It's not clear to me what their unifying popular philosophy is. So I say, you just ride this out. And look, maybe they don't take the Senate. I'm not saying they will. I think they will, but I'm not saying that by shutting up they will take the Senate. What I am saying is I like their odds better by shutting up than by talking. If they can just avoid mistakes, that's a win.
Well, you are implicitly echoing my argument before that the Republicans should take the midterms deliberately because they don't have a coherent set of ideas. They're not on the same page. They still have these factional disputes that would make it very difficult for them if they did win the Senate, because then that debate would happen in a much more prominent, open platform, which could get messy. So they might be better off if they had a bit more time offstage to work out those things.
I'm going to channel Justin Green. Just shoot that down, Bill. Look, they need to take the Senate. They can block Supreme Court nominees, and they can basically shut down Obama's agenda. But I do agree, it's going to be, if Republicans settle on a political philosophy or come close to settling on it, that will be fought out during the presidential race in 2016. And whoever the standard bearer is, if it's Rand Paul, you're going to have a pretty dramatically different foreign policy, potentially, depending on which Rand Paul shows up that day, than if it's Marco Rubio, for example. But I don't think that that has anything to do with, taking the Senate or not taking the Senate.
Well, let me go back to what you were saying before, which is that this could be like 2006, where Democrats did all they had to be was anti-Bush and anti-Iraq war, and that was sufficient to take back Congress. I do think 2014 is different. I agree that it is possible they could just shut up and still take those seats. These are generally seats in right-leaning states in an off year where a Democratic base might not be as motivated as in a presidential year. So you could get there by doing nothing. I don't discount that possibility. But it's certainly not a gimme based on the polls, you have about five races that are dead heat races. And I think it raises a question. Would Republicans have been in a stronger position if they had developed a consistent, agreed-upon set of ideas that had some resonance?
Right.
So why,
but that's
why
a different question, Bill. That's a different question. Look, 6 months ago, I would have agreed, yes, Republicans, conservatives need to be for something. They need to have a governing philosophy, because you can't have a mandate if you don't have a governing philosophy. I've been arguing for a long time that they need to have an alternative to Obamacare. But that's a different question than what should they do today. Between now and the election, which is, you know, we're after Labor Day here, pulling some pulling some policy out of the air, out of thin air, would do more harm than good. At this point, go negative. You know, it's about Obama. It's about all the horrible things happening around the world, pinning him on Obama, which isn't necessarily an unfair thing to do after 6 years. And it either works or it doesn't. But I like it better than trying to, you know, sort of artificially manufacture a proactive policy when they really don't have a consistent one yet.
And I agree with you that to do it, you know, last minute, you know, on the fly, in haste, slapping it together, you know, that could very easily cause problems, because you're not prepared to defend it properly, and you could easily get a lot of holes poked in and get put back on the defensive. But I do think that 2014 is different than 2006 in that in 2006, Republicans controlled everything. And anything that was going wrong in the country could be directly, the blame could be easily affixed to all Republicans. There's no muddying of the waters there. And that made it very easy to say, if you're unhappy with the war, you're unhappy with the economy, do the opposite. Now, I think that's much more muddied, because Republicans, I think, take some public blame for the gridlock, for the inability for Obama to move his agenda. Yes, Obama's numbers are low, but the Republican Party's numbers are lower. So it's not like you're seeing in the poll numbers an ideological shift towards the right. You're seeing a general disgust with Washington totally. So you have, for example, in Louisiana, the Republican campaign against Mary Landrieu is, she's gone Washington, she's been there too long, she lives in a big mansion, she doesn't care about Louisiana anymore. In Kentucky, the Democratic play against Mitch McConnell is, he's been in Washington too long. He's part of the dysfunction. And that's why I think, I mean, look, again, it's possible Republicans could win going the way they're going, but it's not as likely as it might have been if they had a sense of, look, we are a responsible governing party. We did our darndest. We put good ideas on the table, and the Democrats rejected them. If you elect us, we will be in a better position to implement those great ideas. They didn't do that over the course of the year.
I agree with that, but that's water under the bridge. And right now, we have to deal with what is, not what, you know, what should have been or what might have been. We go to war with the army we have, Bill. And if we've learned nothing from Don Rumsfeld, we've learned that there are no knowns here. And I mean, look, I think there's one statistic that Republican strategists are looking at, they're looking at it through this prism, which is to say, all of these states that they're trying to win are states that voted for Romney over Obama, by and large. That's the consistent theme. And so if they can just nationalize it, or they can just make it about Obama, if they can just get Republican voters to vote Republican, or people that voted for in the general election for a Republican president to vote for the Republican Senate candidate, then they win. That's all they need to do. It's a very simple thing. The execution may or may not happen, but the premise is pretty simple. It's not an absurd thing to attempt to do.
You think they should go, because this is sort of, I guess, an open question on both sides. In today's day and age, when there are arguably fewer and fewer genuinely undecided swing voters, is the play to go to your base and try to jack up turnout and have superior get-the-vote operations, or is there still some logic in, you know, blurring the differences, using more centrist language, trying to appeal to what middle is left? What you're saying there seems to suggest you think considering that the map leans right, the states that are up for the Senate, the third of the Senate that's up are in redder states, that they should not be shaving off the rough edges. They should be going hard at the base and trying to run up the score with their base.
No. No, that's not what I'm saying, Bill, because it's not it's complicated because you have you have voters who are behaving as Republicans in the presidential election, and the same voters are behaving as Democrats in the senatorial election. So, for example, we saw it happen in North Dakota for years where they would vote for Bush by overwhelming numbers, and they would vote for Democrats, Dorgan, Conrad, and Pomeroy. The entire federal delegation were Democrats, and they vote for Republican governor, and all those state positions simultaneously. So it's the same voter. It's not about turning. You can't just say we're just going to turn out Republican voters. I mean, you can in some each preface it by saying each state is unique and different. But I think that that what you have to do is you have to get voters to behave the way they behaved in a general election when Obama was on the ballot. So
there is a certain kind of voter in these states that has traditionally been a split-ticket voter, federal v. state, and they are a little bit different than a base voter, and therefore you have to tweak your message to appeal to that voter. That's what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, clearly some of it is turnout and some of it's persuasion. I mean, you know, look, Mary Landrieu wins in Louisiana if she gets a high turnout, say, from African Americans in New Orleans. But having said that, there are a lot of sort of, you know, I don't know, whites in Baton Rouge or in, Alexandria, Louisiana, even, who voted for Mitt Romney and also vote for Mary Landrieu. And so it's not just turnout. It's also persuasion. So I don't think you can just go hard right and ignore the persuasion part. I mean, there are some elections where people do that. Bush sort of did that in 2004, and sometimes it works out of necessity, but it's almost always leads to really bad problems once after you win, because again, it comes down to not having a mandate. And I know I'm sounding like I'm contradicting myself here, but no, I think it's sort of both and neither sort of thing.
What do you make of this attack on Landrieu for living in Washington? I thought the Allison Grimes attack on McConnell was a bit more policy based. You're part of the Washington dysfunction, and you haven't solved the problem. The attack on Landrieu seems to be you live there. How dare we elect you to go to the Senate and then choose to live there near where your job is?
Well, Bill, it's one of those situations. My wife actually is now very recently started consulting on the race of one of her opponents. So I should probably, I think what I said earlier is sort of analysis that's neutral, but I probably shouldn't weigh in too much more. But I'll turn it around on you. Okay. It has been happening. What do you think, Bill Scherer?
Well, I get the idea of going at Washington dysfunction. I look at the polling and I see not a pendulum shift ideologically. I see a unhappiness that Washington can't do stuff. And that doesn't automatically mean it has to be liberal stuff, but I think there's a sense, hey, you know, the economy is not great. Foreign policy, there's a lot of hotspots flip around the world. I want to see Washington do things to solve these problems, get your act together. And I feel that's why this Grimes is making Kentucky competitive.
As you pointed out too, that like this is very similar to the attack on Mitch McConnell in Kentucky.
Right. Well, but the line on Landrieu seems to be, you know, she lives in a big house in Washington. She earmarked money for D.C. public schools. As if she's a nothing for Louisiana at all. This is why I think it would be tough. I mean, she's been around a long time. You know, she's a pretty stout defender of the oil industry in Louisiana. I don't think she's absentee in the state. I mean, the Landrieu name goes back a long way. I think she knows how to touch base and shake hands and be present. So I wouldn't think it would gel as well to say she's done nothing for us and only cares about her D.C. neighbors. I wouldn't think they'd have as much resonance, because I'm not there, and I know you're in a position where you can't.
I know it stinks, man. As if it's it's interesting that that people might assume that I would pull my punches or change my opinions, but probably shouldn't delve too much more into it. Just I have to do what the Republicans have to do, Bill, which is keep my mouth shut between now and November and just coast to victory.
I know your wife is very successful and she deals a lot of candidates, but we didn't talk in advance. What race is she in? So wave me off.
Well, the scary part is that it's like getting so successful now, it's possible I may not know. Maybe people she's doing support I don't even know about, and it creates a little bit of an issue, because obviously there's the whole, I want to disclose any potential for, what I'm saying, Bill.
Right.
Anyway. So I'll have to do like a disclosure to you. I'll have to get a list of all the people and email you things we can't talk about on the DMZ. That's why I've said, I had to put my foot down, Bill. No presidential races, because then I'm done. What am I going to do? It's write about theology all the time or something. Like my latest defense of Joel and Victoria Osteen at the week. That'll be what's left for me.
Can you talk Colorado?
Yes, I can talk Colorado.
Okay, so I thought it was interesting yesterday that Cory
like
Gardner,
that.
The Republican nominee for Senate in Colorado, comes out with an ad where he is supporting over-the-counter birth control. And this is a guy who once was a co-sponsor of the so-called Personhood Amendment, which would give fetuses the legal protections of a person, and Mark Udall, the Democratic incumbent, has been pounding Gardner on that to rally the pro-choice vote in Colorado, which not only is a blue-tinted state in recent years, but has a libertarian streak. So they're trying to jack up both the women's vote and kind of the libertarian pro-choice vote. So Gardner comes out in favor of a form of over-the-counter birth control. Is this an example of the Democratic line, the Republican war on women line, having an impact, where Republicans have played a degree of defense and say, no, I'm for birth control, it's all good, we don't have any problems here. Does the war on women attack, leave a mark?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, this is the war on women attack was incredibly effective. I mean, I would say mostly bogus, if not entirely bogus, but it was very effective. And I think that clearly Gardner is adopting this position to inoculate himself against that attack. We've seen it take down candidates and really just beat up candidates. I would say I think that a couple things. One, the place that Republicans are at in regards to the birth control issue is really almost a product of having been so successful. In other words, for a long time, Republicans were winning on the abortion issue, and they had Democrats on defense, sort of having to defend things like late-term or partial birth abortion, which put them in a very difficult spot to defend. And then I think the more Republicans were succeeding at this issue, it kind of emboldened them to take it to the next level. So then you started having things like the transvaginal ultrasound issue pop up, like the birth control issue or the personhood issue pop up, which I think on its face, to me, sounds good. The idea that a baby should be a person, considered a person, sounds really good. The problem is that once you start getting in the weeds of the specifics of what that policy entails in terms of what's birth control, what's an abortifacient, now all of a sudden Republicans or conservatives find themselves out on this fringe defending something that's much easier to defend protecting life and But it's hard once you start getting out there. It's almost like when the Democrats found themselves defending partial birth abortion, much harder to do than just defending, say, the right to choose as an abstract principle. So anyway, I think this is a smart move by Garner, but I do think yes, it is a product of the war on women having been so effective.
Now, I have not followed this race closely, but I know we're taping on Wednesday. Perhaps by the time this goes up, it might be after the fact. But I believe tonight is the first debate in the North Carolina Senate race. Can you talk North Carolina?
I can talk about it. I know next to nothing about it. If we're gonna do politics here, man, I'm gonna have to start delving into these races.
I won't go too deep, but we don't need to discuss it. But just so people know,
I am prepared to talk about the Orioles Nationals, the World Series that I don't know what we're gonna call it, the Beltway World Series with the Orioles and the Nationals. I'm utterly prepared to discuss that. If that should come, I'm just saying if it comes up, you know, in the course of our conversation.
We don't need to talk. People should know the debate in North Carolina is tonight. If this is being posted after the fact, I'm sure it'll be up on C-SPAN. I believe it's the first Senate debate post Labor Day, post, you know, fall sprint. So I think it's interesting to watch to see how the candidates position themselves vis-a-vis Obama, vis-a-vis national Republicans. Are they playing to their base? Are they playing to the middle? You know, Obama won the state in 2008. He lost it in 2012. There's a very hard right Republican majority at the state level now. Is that causing a backlash? There's a big Moral Mondays protest movement there that is rising. Does Kay Hagan, the incumbent Democrat, you know, lean that way, or does she want to lean to the right in some respect? Does the Republican Tom Tillis, you know, does he want to embrace what the state legislator is doing? He is the House Speaker, or does he put some distance between him and the other right wingers? That I think it'd be interesting to watch.
Yeah, it will be, and I think, you know, we talked earlier about Republican, you know, can they win all these races? And this just, you know, knowing the little that I know, it seems to me I think if I have to bet on this one, I think I bet Democrat, just because I don't know how easy you can demonize the Democrat and tie her to Obama. And I do know that Tillis, the Republican, right? I mean, he had to go back into the state Senate or the state House or something for a session. And I think that, you know, that sort of slowed down his momentum a little bit. So it seems like North Carolina possibly, you know, potentially a missed opportunity. And had they, you know, it's one of those states, there are several states where they ended up running, Republicans ended up running candidates who, you know, were from like the state House or the state Senate, not members of Congress, not known statewide. And you just wonder if they had a better year recruiting candidates, top tier candidates, what it might have been like.
Right. So moving away from midterm stuff, Rand Paul, back in the news, he's trying to, he wants to play in the foreign policy debate. He had various points, has tried to push Republicans away from their traditional hawkishness and towards a more restrained foreign policy. I talked about this in a political piece a couple weeks ago, which was headlined as Hillary Too Hawkish to Win 2016, but the subhead was, Is Rand Paul Too Dovish? And it noted that he criticized Republicans for being too hard on Putin back in February, and then a few days later, Putin goes into Crimea, and Rand Paul had to readjust his message. In June, he does an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying America shouldn't take sides in the Iraq Civil War. This was after ISIS had taken over a couple of Iraqi cities, and the talk of attacking ISIS had kicked up again, but before Obama's airstrikes have happened. He was saying, you know, the text of the piece was not quite definitive, but it certainly articulated great skepticism of airstrikes, suggesting why should we take sides. We didn't do this in Syria because ISIS is fighting Assad. We seem to be against Assad and tipping towards ISIS. Why are we against ISIS in Iraq? Does that bring us closer to Iran? This is all a big mess. We should stay out. Now, just this week, he's saying, oh, if I was president, I would have a congressional authorization to strike ISIS. And, you know, you could delve into the details of what the nuance of what he said and say, okay, it's not quite 180 degrees flip-flop, but it's kind of like 160 degrees flip-flop because he left that door open a crack in the past op-eds, with some qualifying language. But the overall emphasis of the earlier piece was stay out. And now he's saying he'd go in. And it's not like ISIS became different. This was after they had taken over two cities. I mean, the only thing different
changed,
is that
they... man. It used to be about the music.
Is he able to... if he can't stick to his guns in 2014, what does he do in 2016 when the intensity of the media scrutiny is a hundredfold? And, you know, events change. Developments happen. Is he ready for prime time?
Well, look, I have a lot of thoughts about this. First, Rand does have a point. You know, when you go back to some of the hawks like John McCain, who wanted to arm the rebels against Assad, it is entirely possible that they would have been putting weapons in the hands of ISIS.
Which is why Obama was hesitant to do so for that very reason.
But then you could argue that had Obama done it earlier, that there was a time when there were more moderate rebels that could have been funded and armed. But by the time Obama got ready to do it, I mean, I know this sounds like sophistry, and maybe it's true, maybe it's not. But the point I'm describing now is essentially Rubio's point, which I happen to believe, but who knows. But anyway, be that as it may... So Paul does sort of have a point, but I can't help but thinking the world that has gotten much more dangerous, or at least the news of foreign policy and international relations has ratcheted up in the last year or two, that hurts Paul, you kind of disproportionately. That, you know, I've argued that the public doesn't really have a foreign policy as much as that they react to events, and that they're fickle, and so I think that may hurt Paul. The interesting thing is, this isn't just foreign policy. Well, first let me say, we're putting aside Ron Paul's statements, which if we delved into that, we'd be here all day. I'm not even going to bring in what Ron Paul has said about Russia and ISIS and all that. But just based on Rand Paul's statements alone, it's not just foreign policy, it's immigration. He's on every side of that issue. I mean, he's pro-immigration reform, but there'll never be a bill that he's supporting. He can't be for amnesty, but he is pro-immigration reform. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's very Clinton-esque, Bill Clinton-esque. And it seems like he gets away with it. It seems like he's not smooth like Clinton, but he seems to be Teflon. Get away with it.
That's right. Bill Clinton, 1991, during the Iraq War, after the Iraq War, he said, I would have voted with the majority, but I agree with the arguments the minority made. You know, that was not exactly that was not the smoothest Clintonism. You know,
I actually voted for that bill before I voted against it.
Well, that was a far more clunkier line than John Kerry's. I mean, John Kerry was trying to make a point about the need to have the money for be attached to a strategy, and just articulate it in kind of a clumsy way. I mean, Bill was fundamentally saying, I would vote the opposite of my beliefs. And that is far, far worse. But as it turned out, you know, the 1992 was not argued over foreign policy, it was argued over domestic policy, and nobody cared. So there's times you can get away with that stuff, but there's other times, particularly in the thick of battle. Clinton wasn't hit from fellow Democrats. You know, Bush tried to hit him with it, you know, in the general, and at that point, everyone cared about the economy. for Rand, you know, when you're in the primaries and you rise to the top tier, the media scrutiny just becomes white hot. And if a Republican opponent wants to hit you with something you said, you know, that's going to get a lot of attention. And, yeah. and I
but they're really good. They are really good, though. Paul is really good at writing the op-ed that addresses the zeitgeist, you know, of the moment. But upon closer inspection, is a departure, is inconsistent with things he said a month ago. And I guess you're right, Bill. I mean, what is missing? And I wonder why this isn't happening now. I mean, it's not like Paul doesn't have his enemies amongst the neocons specifically. I mean, why isn't there the video showing the dichotomy between what he's saying here versus there? Because it does strike me that people maybe just haven't been shown the dexterity, you know, the flexibility of Rand Paul yet.
Well, I mean, so you get me the occasional news piece. I think Ann Coulter, you know, dinged him once or twice on this stuff. But I got to think that if you're Rick Perry, if you're Marco Rubio, if you're Ted Cruz, you know, Ted Cruz's foreign policy is closer to Rick Perry than it is for Rand Paul. You're collecting these clips. You're keeping a database. You're gonna drop it when it's right to drop it. It's not that they were gonna. I doubt these things are getting forgotten by his intra-party enemies. And I think the question
that's
becomes.
That's why I've always felt like it's a house of cards. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like Rand has a lot going for him, and you know, he's leading some. In some cases, he's leading in Iowa and New Hampshire in these early polls. But I do feel like it's possible that that it's a house that he folds like a cheap suit. You know what I mean? Like that it looks like this juggernaut, but it can't withstand the scrutiny. I mean, sometimes we think that, and sometimes we think of it, and it doesn't happen. Sometimes we think that someone is susceptible. You know, the support's a mile wide and an inch deep, and it doesn't turn out that way.
I mean, the question for any upstart who wants to, you know, make it to the big time and be in the top tier of presidential politics, there's going to be a moment, either fairly or unfairly, either you made a mistake or someone's doing a cheap shot on you, where you're going to have to prove you can counterattack in the crucible, whether it is, you know, properly explaining yourself like Obama's race speech after the Jeremiah Wright flap, or whether it's Bill Clinton in 1992, you know, just turning everything back around and his opponents, you know, when he was hit with charges of draft dodging and adultery, you're gonna have to show you can take a punch and fight back. And
yeah, I think that's a good point, Bill. You know, it's a cliche in life. We tell kids, you know, It's not how many times you get knocked down, it's how many times you get up. But it really is true. And in politics, these are political athletes. And I mean, you said not, you know, using the boxing analogy, it's not a stretch. I mean, there are similarities that this is part of the reason we watch this like a spectator sport and cover it like a sport is that there are parallels. And that it shows that it's not just looking big and strong and tough. Eventually, you are going to have to show resilience, toughness, stick-to-itiveness, and that is how you prove your mettle, and it's part of the way that you signal that you have, as Richard Ben Cramer said, what it takes to be president. So that's a good point, and I think nobody gets out of this alive, as you know. nobody comes out of this unscathed. Every candidate eventually has to pass that crucible.
And I just, you know, this is early, and everyone hates that we get ahead of ourselves, all this stuff, and then we can't predict, we can't get inside people's heads. But when I look at, Paul and Paul Ryan and Marco Rubio and Rick Perry and Mike Huckabee, what I think, which of those guys can take the best punch? Who's proven they can take that punch
right
and come back at you twice hard? I would say Rick Perry. I think Rick Perry, I mean, even though he, you know, the oops thing, you know, was the end, You know, that guy went down fighting. That guy did not just roll over and crumple up into a ball. He went out and, like, he threw a whole bunch of roundhouses after that. No one was paying attention. But, you know, I think he walked out of the race with his head held high. Yeah.
Well, they've all been, that's the other thing, they've all been beaten up. I mean,
right.
And I wonder if that's a good thing or a bad thing, right? I mean, Rubio's had been chastened by the immigration issue. You know, got Bridgegate with Chris Christie. I guess Cruz hasn't really, I mean, you and I know that the whole shutting down the government thing was absurd, but I think he hasn't come to terms with that. So
I just don't take Cruz seriously at all. But Rubio, I think Rubio handled the immigration thing poorly. He got punched in the face and he shrunk away from it and tried to scramble and find, you know, ground somewhere else.
He fought it bravely for a long time. No, he did. He endured what he did was a profile in courage unlike any of the others. I mean, none of the others spoke truth to power to their own base. And so I give Rubio a lot of credit for attempting something that nobody else had the guts to attempt and for withstanding immense pressure for a sustained period of time. However, it is very clear to me that that had a psychic toll on him and that he is not the man he was before. And the question is, can he get it back? The larger question, Bill, is, are you better off entering into this Republican scrum having never been attacked, being strong and having not been challenged? Or are you better off entering it as Marco Rubio, who has taken a punch, as Chris Christie, who's taken a punch, as Rick Perry, who was a mockery for a year or two?
Yeah, I mean Chris Christie, we know he takes a punch, he's not going to back down. I just think that I think the bridge baggage is heavier than the oops baggage, because Rick Perry can overcome an oops by having sharp debates. You know, he's in control of how he can rise above that. If he makes another mental slip like that again, then he's toast. If he doesn't, wow, that just shows that was a one time thing, you know, and that's not who the man is. I think the bridge thing has become emblematic of who Christie is as a person. This guy,
it sounds
just
like you're writing off the whole Rick Perry indictment thing then too. That you're assuming that.
I can't predict where that's going to go. I mean, not being an expert in the Texas law and how that court case is going to go. I mean, that there's the possibility that could chew him up. If it leads to a reputation that is Christie-like, that he was being a political bully and skirting with the fringes of the law in doing so. But people could also say, look, this was, you know, a complicated story. You know, yeah, you know, if his elbow was a little sharp, it was for good reason, because this woman was drunk. It's not how he runs the state top to bottom. It wasn't for selfish political end, even if he is technically guilty. And therefore, I'm not going to hold it against them. Whereas the bridge thing just seems so raw. Like, how far does one have to punch down to make hundreds of commuters suffer so you can get one measly mayor's endorsement? That just strikes me as a much harder thing to swallow.
So, but I don't know if we've answered the question. Would you rather be someone like a Ted Cruz who goes into this having not really been beaten down, or would you rather go into this having endured the slings and arrows and having had your team have to go into crisis mode, knowing what it's like? Given the choice, which would you prefer?
Well, yeah, I mean, as we know, Obama was, you know, pretty green, you know, going into the whole thing. This is the tricky thing. If you go into a presidential race with little paper trail, you can kind of catch lightning in a bottle a little better, because you're a fresh face. There's no obvious points of attack. The question is, when you are green, you are more prone to make mistakes or more prone to an October surprise kind of thing. Yeah. And so
the trick is, be green, no paper trail, but be able to bring it. You know,
that's right. And I think,
it right the first time, basically.
And that's why I think Obama was unusual in that respect, in that he was able. I mean, he endured a lot of slings and arrows, and he beat them back very ably and capably. It made Democrats feel like, okay, this guy can handle it. I trust this guy can take on John McCain. This guy is not soft. If you're gonna be green like that, you better make sure you got your act together, because it's gonna get pretty brutal.
Right. Well, without getting too partisan here, I would certainly argue that that the inexperience did not hurt him electorally, but we may be seeing some of the fruits of it amongst he was able to take on John McCain, but maybe foreign policy leaders prove more daunting, and maybe experience turned out to matter in the real world.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can shift topic here. It's a pretty interesting topic to shift to. Obviously, that is a narrative that's being pushed right now, and Hillary might even implicitly play upon that narrative to say this is time for more experience, someone who is a steady hand, yada yada yada. But there's certainly points, say, in Reagan's tenure. I mean, Reagan was not a foreign policy aficionado going into the presidency, where you might have said, wow, that Lebanon thing, when that was a botch. he had a terrible time managing his own foreign policy team. He did not manage the conflicts between defense and state. He blundered into a messy foreign policy, and a whole lot of people got killed. Or he was somewhat unsteady dealing with the Philippine Revolution. He hung on to Marcos for a long time before his aides had to convince him that it was time to back off. But things like that. But of course, today we don't look at those things. We look at how he handled Gorbachev, and he gets credit for ending the
right.
Cold War. During those negotiations, a lot of folks on the right thought he was being soft on Gorbachev and didn't have the steel for the job. So I think you got to wait. I can't blame folks for taking pot shots in the middle of a presidency. But the judgment's going to get rendered after the whole 8 years is done. FDR, there's a great blogger, a professor, Matt Dickinson from Middlebury, who did a post this week saying, look, people were haranguing FDR in 1940 and 41, even within his own cabinet, for dithering. Why is he not standing up to Hitler and Mussolini? Why is he biding his time? What's he waiting for? The great book, Those Angry Days, captures that frustration, very, very capably. And as Dickinson argued, FDR realized that just he had no good options at that juncture, and he was biding his time until an opening presented itself, and then Pearl Harbor came, and then he had the opening to go in with full force, and that he was suggesting perhaps Obama was waiting for his moment, and maybe that's the ISIS is his moment. It's hard to fully appreciate. Well, it's hard to appreciate what it's like when you are the president, when you got to factor in all the different potential consequences of action, whereas a guy on the sidelines can look at it more narrowly. And we'll see what things look like in a couple of years after developments change, and you'll assess the full record. So I think it's premature to say never elect someone who has no foreign policy experience, because it will always be a disaster, because there's plenty of situations where Clinton, no foreign policy experience, his foreign policies, it was considered pretty credible right now. People like Reagan's foreign policy, maybe six right now. So I think that is, I would say it's an oversimplified view of what works and what doesn't.
Well, I would totally agree with you that, as George W. Bush often said, you'll be judged, history will judge you, and it's going to take a long, many, many years before the historians have a sense of who was good and who was bad, and how things played out. Having said that, I think that probably if you were alive in 1978 or 79, you had a sense things weren't going so well, and it kind of seems like that again. But the larger point is certainly correct. I mean, we don't know how things are going to shake out, and that will certainly impact the way that Obama's tenure is viewed historically.
Well, even Carter, Carter doesn't get the credit for this so much, but he was obviously not. He was in over his head. The world was spinning out of control, and it was all his fault. His measures seemed very feeble. The boycott of the Olympics and the failed rescue attempt on Iran. But if you read the book "Guests of the Ayatollah" by Mark Bowden, he does criticize Carter for allowing that kind of sense to take hold that he was trapped by circumstances. You know, he certainly didn't manage the optics of the situation all that well, but he exonerates him for the rescue, in that it was a difficult rescue. He didn't go into it lightly, and they actually the crash happened after they had decided on the ground that they had some malfunction with the helicopters and they shouldn't go on, that they were turning back because they were being cautious. They didn't have manpower after they hit this horrible sandstorm that was highly unusual, and it messed up their choppers, and they were going to turn and go home, and then it was dark and sandy, and the choppers crashed into each other.
That's not horrible.
Carter's fault. Yeah. But at the end of the day, even though it took a long time, and even though it didn't make Carter look good, and arguably lost him his reelection, the hostages were freed without any bloodshed, which was actually quite impressive. You know? It took quite a bit of negotiation on Carter's part to make that happen, especially since it was hard to negotiate with the Iranians because they didn't have a single point of contact. Their whole government was a mess at that point. So he actually credits Carter for some very patient and careful diplomacy and not making rash decisions that could have caused, you know, a big regional conflict. But
I don't want to beat up on Carter too. I mean, someone was just recently telling me that Carter allowed missionaries, like groups like World Vision or whatever, to rescue Vietnamese boat people that were basically fleeing, you know, the communist regime and plagued by pirates, and nobody would allow them to, like, land. And so missionaries, because of Carter, were allowed to go over and save them. And I mean, that's amazing and great. He basically made that happen. But I think that we would agree he's probably widely considered to be a failed president. But the
optics fair, question is interesting. You know, there's all this debate. You know, we even talked about Obama's golfing. But Carter essentially, you know, is the guy who didn't golf. He stayed in the White House. There's a crisis going on. I'm at my desk. I'm not going to leave until this crisis is solved. And you know, there is some honor in doing that, but the optics of it ended up being very poor because it made him seem trapped. He was beholden to what the hostages were doing. He wasn't sticking to his own schedule, and Bush Senior pushed against that logic when Saddam Hussein took hostages in the run up to the Iraq wars after he invaded Kuwait, and Bush had sent some military force to the Gulf, but he hadn't declared the war yet. And it was just a few days after he sent those ships, they went on a three-week vacation in Maine while Saddam had hostages, while the military was getting in position. And, you know, no other than Maureen Dowd had a news report in the New York Times, you know, knocking Bush for playing golf while this was all going on. But it was done deliberately to say, you know, you, Saddam Hussein, are not going to change my schedule. You know, you don't have my balls in a sling. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. You don't have anything over on me. You know, you may have these hostages, but they're not going to get you anything. So forget it.
Right. And so you always have to wonder when it comes to foreign policy, you do have to wonder if things that are said are said for, because they're true, or because it's psychological warfare, or gamesmanship, or diplomacy, and so that is a factor. One does imagine that I guess two things: that one, there maybe there's a happy medium between being holed up in the White House wearing your cardigan with the you know heat on 65 or whatever, versus playing golf constantly. The other thing, you know, is that, look, I mean, I think Obama needs to be cognizant of political realities. And George H.W. Bush, as you'll recall, lost his reelection. Now, Obama doesn't have to stand for reelection, but, you know, there are political consequences to this. And I wonder if, let's give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that for a second here that he's, you know, calling them the JV, for example, is a way of messing with them, of psychological warfare. Assuming that's true, I wonder if he's factored in the political fallout from that sort of calculation.
I mean, obviously, it doesn't look good in the middle of it, but does it really affect what the ultimate policy is going to be? I mean, if Obama gets in there with a military strategy that really knocks these guys on their backs, are you going to remember the you know, we don't have a strategy yet?
But he could lose the Senate between now and the time that happens.
Well, I mean, again, that I don't think that would be the tipping point for the Senate. I mean, the Senate was a tough road, you know, the whole time. And arguably is going to turn more on domestic issues in the economy than it is on ISIS. I mean, most of the commentary about the most recent comments was that he's making us look weak in the eyes of ISIS, and that will embolden ISIS. And I think that's probably a very
well. I keep hoping he's
sophomore.
I keep hoping he's trying to lull them into a false sense of security. But I'm losing hope that that's the case.
I just don't think it matters one way or the other. I mean, I think ISIS is going to do what they're going to do, and we're going to do what we're going to do. And, you know, the quote, you know, what they do in a video and what Obama says at the podium is really not going to matter what happens in the military theater.
See, I think that's a fundamental difference in worldview between conservatives and liberals. I mean, and maybe this goes back to Reagan's peace through strength thing, but I think that conservatives really do believe that that the image you project invites trouble or not, and it sounds like you don't necessarily believe that's true. You think that they act independently of whether or not they perceive us as tough. And I mean
it's a standard article of Republican faith that the Iran hostages were released at the moment Reagan was inaugurated, because the Iranians saw Reagan's steely eyes and realized what they're up against and immediately freed the hostages. Well, that doesn't really explain Lebanon, does it? You know, I think that these actions get made independent of these what glimpses you see on TV. There's a lot of other political factors and geopolitical factors at play.
I think we'll have to agree to disagree on that, but that strikes me. Well, that strikes me as a fundamental difference between these worldviews of conservatives and liberals. And maybe some of it may come down to the difference over whether or not you think that the image you project. I mean, you know, if you walk down the street and you're 6'4" and you got some swagger, probably less likely someone's going to mess with you than if you're scrawny and you're sort of slinking down the street. I don't want to blame the victim here, Bill, but I think body language experts, some of whom probably appear on cable news, would agree with me that that the image that you project could make it more or less likely, say, for example, that you were a victim of a mugging.
I mean, Lebanon happened under Reagan. Kuwait was invaded under Bush Sr. World Trade Center bombing happened under Clinton. 9/11 happened under George Bush. ISIS happened under Obama. I mean, bad things happen. You know, people have reasons to do bad things, regardless of what kind of image the individual president portrays.
Well, you're just wrong about that,
though. Should we leave it on that note with me being wrong?
Yes, I think that's always a good place to end it. But it was good, even though you're wrong, it was good to be back in the DMZ, the warm sweet spot that is the DMZ.
The warm cockles.
Everything else going, you know, mad out there, but in here in the DMZ, it's our safe spot.
Bastion of sanity. So until between now and next week, your homework is to send me a list of states that you're allowed to talk about and states you're not allowed to talk about.
First, I have to debrief my better half to find out what those states are.
And I want House races, too.
Yeah.
I want the whole gamut. Jeez. And governor's races. I want everything.
I will, and it's a moving target. That's the other thing. These things, they're added, subtracted, but I will do that. That's a good thing. That way we can delve into some of these races a little bit. And it would be good for me to know too. So I'll have to do a debriefing, and then I'll have my people talk to your people. And, everyone out there, check us out on Twitter at DMZ Show and Facebook/DMZ Show. You can post comments. suggested topics for the show. How about that? Bill, Matt, we'd like to have you guys talk about this. Maybe suggest guests when Bill or I, you know, go on sabbatical. Anything like that, weigh in on what you think on Twitter at DMZ Show, Facebook/DMZ Show, and check us out here on Blogging Heads. It, last thing, Bill, I say this from time to time. You know, this is a podcast too, an audio podcast. So if you're on the metro, you're on the treadmill, you don't have time to watch the show, you can go on iTunes and look for DMZ Show or Blogging Heads. You can just listen to the audio of this and hear the sweet, you know, sounds of Bill Scherer's voice there, whispering crazy leftist diatribes into your ear. So
I think all of my snarky comments that I mumble under my breath, you know, you can't get on the video, but you'll hear it clear as day on the podcast.
Well, sometimes I hear people say in the comments that you were patronizing, rolling your eyes, humoring me.
Are you talking to my wife?
So, you know, if you don't like the Bill, you know, you don't like Bill doing that, you can just listen to the podcast and you won't notice that. So that's good too.
All right, till next week, sir.
All right. See you later. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.